Turl repeated Zt. This bomber drone has not been flown in 1,000 years. It's a wreck.
We're rebuilding it, aren't we? Snarled Turl, finishing his presets and standing up.
Turl, maybe you don't know that this was the original Conquest drone. It was the one that gassed this planet before our takeover.
Well, I'm loading it with gas canisters, ain't I?
But, Turl, we've already conquered this planet 1,000 or more years ago. You release kill gas now, even in just a few places, and it might hit our own mine sites.
They use breathe gas,
snapped Turl, shouldering by Zt and walking back into the huge plane. Workmen were trundling up big gas canisters from deep underground storage. They had to burnish them gingerly to get the crud of ages off them. Turl energetically directed the workers, hooking them in place.
15 canisters. You've only brought 14. Get another one.
Some workmen rushed off, and Turl was hooking wires up to the canister release valves, muttering to himself, checking color coding.
Turl, they only kept this drone as a curiosity piece. These things are dangerous. It's one thing to remote guide a recon drone with its small motors. They don't override the controls. But this thing has motors like 12 ore freighters. The signals it sends back to a remote get overridden by its own motors. It could charge around and release gas almost any place. They're too erratic for competent use. And once you start them, you can't stop them. Like transshipment firing, they're irreversible.
Shut up, said Turl.
In the regulations, persisted Zt, it says these things only get used in most extreme emergency. There is no emergency, Turl.
Shut up, said Turl, going on with his wire matching.
And you've ordered it permanently parked in front of the automatic firing bay. We need that for servicing ore freighters. This is a war drone, and they only use them for primary attack on a planet and never use them afterward except on a withdrawal. There is no war, and we're not withdrawing from this planet.
Turl had had enough. He threw down his notes and loomed over Zt.
I am the best judge of these things. Where there is no war department on a planet, the security chief has that post. My orders are final. This drone gets parked at the hangar firing door, and don't you move it. As to control...
He shook the small, 1-foot square box in front of Zt's face.
All it needs is the date setting and firing buttons pushed in, and there's nothing erratic after that. This drone will go and do what it's supposed to do, and it stays on standby.
Zt backed up. Dollies were moving the huge old relic over to the firing door, where it would be in the way of everything and leave no other door to service freighters.
Those were awfully funny locations you were punching in, Zt said faintly.
Turl was holding a big wrench. He walked closer to Zt.
They're man names for planet locations. They're the places where man animals were left.
That little handful? Ventured Zt.
Turl screamed something and threw the wrench at him.
Zt ducked, and it went clanging across the hangar floor, making workers dodge.
You're acting kind of insane, Turl, said Zt.
Only alien races ever go insane, screamed Turl.
Zt stood aside as they dollied the ancient drone to the firing door.
It's going to stay right there,
yelled Turl at nobody in particular.
It'll get fired any time in the next 4 months.
And for sure on day 93, he smiled to himself. Zt wondered for a moment whether he ought to shoot Turl when they were in some quiet place. Turl had restored weapons to the employees, refilled the weapon racks in compound halls, let them wear belt guns again. Then he remembered that Turl had an envelope parked somewhere in case of death. Later, Zt mentioned it privately to Numpf. Zut liked to hunt, and the bomber drone would wipe out most of the game again. Numph had also liked to hunt once. But Numph just sat there and looked woodenly at him. The bomber drone, the one originally shipped in to gas and conquer the planet, remained standing at the firing door in everybody's way, filled with lethal gas, preset, just requiring a few punches of the remote Turl kept in his own possession. Zut shuddered every time he passed it. Turl had obviously gone stark raving mad. That night in his quarters, Turl did feel spinny. Another day, and he had gotten absolutely no clue as to what J-Ed was up to, what the agent was looking for. Turl followed the recon drone photos. The animals were burrowing underground now, which was smart. They might possibly make it, and if they didn't, he had his answers. He looked in on the females every evening, throwing wood and meat at them. Sometimes he found packages outside the cage door. He chose not to think about how they got there, and threw them in too. He'd fixed the water, but so it overflowed. The bigger one was sitting up again. He never saw them without being nagged by the puzzle of psychic powers. He wondered which one of them sent out the impulses and whether they could be read on a scope. Oh, well, as long as the animals up in the mountains worked, he'd keep these females alive. It was good leverage. But on day 93, ha! He could not count on the animals not talking. He could not count on the company or government not catching up with him. The animals had to go, and this time, all of them. Turl fell asleep, floundering around in a half-conceived possibility. J-Ed was denying him gold. It was J-Ed's fault. But how did one commit the perfect murder of a top agent of the IBI? It made one's head spin to try to work it out. Meantime, he would be the model of efficiency. He had to look like the greatest, most cautious and alert security chief the company had ever known. Was he crazy, really? No. Just clever. 4. Johnny was going home. In a canyon above the village meadow, they unloaded 4 horses and a pack from the freight plane. The breath of the horses hung about them in small, thin puffs. The horses, very recently wild, had not liked the ride and stamped about and snorted when their blindfolds were removed. The air was clear and frosty at this altitude. Snow from the recent storm covered the world and silenced it. Angus McTavish and Parson McGilvey were with Johnny. A pilot had come along so that the plane could be moved in case the visit lasted longer than a day. The recon drone had already gone by when they took off from the base, and the plane should not be there when it passed again. A week ago, Johnny had awakened in the night with the sudden realization that he might know where some uranium was. His own village. He had no great hope for it, but the signs were there in the illness of his people. Possibly there was no great amount, but also, possibly, there was more than that single rock from Uravan. He felt a trifle guilty for having to have an ulterior motive to go home, for there were other reasons. His people should be moved, both because of their continuous exposure to radiation, and also because they should not be exposed in any future bombing. Johnny and his men had scoured the mountains for another possible home, and only yesterday had they found one. It was an old mining town on the western slope, lower in altitude, open through a narrow pass to a western plain. A brook ran down the street in the town center. Many of the buildings and houses still retained glass. Wild cattle and game were plentiful. But even better, there was a large, half-mile-long tunnel behind the town that could serve as refuge. A coal deposit was on the hill nearby. The place was beautiful. It had no trace of uranium in it. Johnny did not think the people of the village would move. He had tried before as a youth, and even his father had thought he was just being restless. But he had to try again. Angus and the parson had insisted on coming with him. He had explained the dangers of exposure to radiation to them, and had not wanted to put them at risk. But Angus simply waved a breathe gas bottle and promised to check it out ahead of them and not be foolish about it. And the parson, being a wise and experienced member of the clergy, knew Johnny might need help. They knew better than to simply fly a plane into the meadow. The people had seen recon drones all their lives, but a plane close up might terrify them. Part of last night had been spent planning. Angus and the parson had been briefed. There would be no action that might alarm the people. No talk of monsters. No frightening tidings about Chrissy. It would be strange enough to be seen entering from the upper canyon, for the pass on the eastern side of the meadow and all such passes were now choked with snow. And so they rode, three mounted men and a heavily laden pack horse, down into the meadow. The horse's hoofs made little sound in the loose snow. The deserted cabins on the outskirts were dilapidated and forlorn. Only a whiff of pungent wood smoke was in the air. Where were the dogs? Johnny drew up. The corral where horses were kept was empty. Then he listened carefully and heard a stamp in the old barn sheds beyond. There was a horse there, possibly more than one. He looked toward the pens where wild cattle were usually driven in before the first snow. There were not many cattle there, not enough to last through the winter. Angus slid down and, as he had promised, did a test for radiation. There was no reaction directly ahead of them. Where were the dogs? True, they were not used to anything coming in the back door of the valley, but it was strange. Johnny rode on toward the courthouse below them. Angus made another test ahead of them. There was no reaction. An old hound came out of a ruin and looked at them with half-blind eyes. It came forward cautiously, belly deep in the snow. It approached Johnny, sniffing hard, wisps of vapor rising from its nose. Then it began to wag its tail, coming closer, wagging harder and harder until the tail was almost whipping the dog's face as he doubled on himself with greeting. The hound began to yelp with welcome. Three or four more dogs sounded down in the village center. Johnny dismounted to pat the hound. It was Panther, one of his family's dogs. He walked on, leading the horse, the dog rheumatically trying to cavort about him. A gaunt-eyed child peered at them from the corner of a building and then ran off, stumbling and falling in the snow. Johnny stopped at the courthouse and looked in. The door was off its hinges and the place was empty and cold. Snow had drifted well into the main room. He came out and surveyed the scene of the quiet, ruined village. He saw smoke coming from the roof of his family's house and walked over to it. He knocked. There were sounds within, and then the door cracked open. It was his Aunt Ellen. She just stood there, staring through the slit. Then,
"Johnny?"
And then,
"But you're dead, Johnny."
She opened the door wide and stood there crying. After a little, she wiped her eyes with a doeskin apron.
"Come in, Johnny. I kept your room, but we gave your things to the young men. Come in. The cold is getting in the house."
"Is there illness in the village?" said Johnny, thinking of his companions.
"Oh, no. Nothing unusual. There was a deer seen on the hills, and the men are all up there trailing it. There's not too much food, Johnny. Not since you went away."
Then she realized it sounded like an accusation.
"I mean..."
She was crying again. Johnny felt a tug at his heartstrings. She was growing old before her time. She was gaunt, her face bones showing too plainly. Johnny brought in Angus and the parson, and they warmed themselves at the fire. Aunt Ellen had never seen a stranger before in her life, and she was a little frightened. But she acknowledged the introductions and then busied herself getting them some hot soup made from boiled bones, and they said it was very good. She stopped flashing questioning glances at Johnny and was pleased with them.
"Chrissy found you?"
she finally ventured to ask. Chrissy is alive, said Johnny. So is Patty. No alarm. Don't alarm them.
I'm so glad. I was so worried. But she would ride off. Your horse eventually came back, you know.
She started to cry again, and then came over and gave Johnny a violent hug. She went off to prepare beds for them in case they spent the night. Johnny went out and found the small child who had spotted them, and sent him up the hill to recall the party that had been after the deer. It was past 4 when he finally got the town council assembled. He was surprised that it was only old Jimson and Brown Limper's staffer. The third member had died recently, and no other was appointed. Johnny had gotten a fire going in the courthouse and propped the door back up. He introduced Angus and the parson, and the town council acknowledged them a bit worriedly. Like Aunt Ellen, they had never before seen strangers. But Angus and the parson withdrew inconspicuously to the side. Johnny made his business known to the town council. No alarm. He told them he had discovered the valley was unhealthy, and that was why they had so few children and so many deaths, and that he had originally gone off to find a better location, and had finally done so. The new town was very nice. It had water available in the main street, and less snow and more game and better houses and even some black rock that burned very hot, and it was a very nice place. It was a good plea and very well presented. Old Jimson was interested and looked very favorable. He consulted with Brown Limper, as was correct. Brown Limper held old grudges against Johnny. Look what had happened. Johnny had gone off, and this had drawn away Chrissy and Patty, probably to their deaths. And now here was Johnny Goodboy Tyler turned up a year and a half or more later with some demand that they move their homes. These were their homes. They had always been safe here, and that was that. They took a vote. It was a tie. The town council didn't know what to do. There used to be a village assembly, a town meeting, said Johnny. There hasn't been one in all my life, said Brown Limper. Yes, I know of those, said Jimson. One was held 30 years ago to change the location of the stock pens. As the council is tied, said Johnny, it should call a town meeting. Brown Limper didn't like it, but there was nothing else they could do. By this time, several people had drifted by from curiosity, and Johnny had no trouble sending word out to collect the people into the courthouse. It was 5 and dark when they all came. Johnny had gotten more wood and built up the fire. He knew better than to light a miner's lamp for illumination. When, at last, he looked at them, sitting on benches and on the floor, faces bathed in the firelight of the smoky room, he felt very bad. They were a beaten people. They were gaunt, some of them ill. The children were too quiet. There were only 28 now. A flaming rage at the cyclos surged up in him. He made himself very calm. He smiled at them when he felt more like weeping. Johnny began, with the council's permission, by opening up his pack. There were gifts. He handed out some dried meat, some bundles of kinnikinick for food flavoring, and some very live flints that would strike long trains of sparks. The people found these very acceptable and thanked him. Then Johnny took out some stainless steel axes and showed them what they would do by cutting a large piece of firewood with one blow. The people were impressed. Johnny handed them out as presents. That done, he got out a bundle of stainless steel knives. When he showed how they cut, warning them not to cut their fingers, the women were quite excited. He handed those around. Finally, he got down to business and told them all about the new town and how easy it would be to move. He didn't tell them they would be flown to it, for he knew he would have sacrificed credibility. No one asked questions when they were invited. Johnny had a foreboding. He took a triangle of broken glass from his pouch and showed them that you could see through it. He told them that in the new town, a lot of the windows had this in them, and it let light in and kept the cold out. He passed the glass around. A little boy cut himself on it slightly, and the glass was quickly handed back. He told them this valley was making them ill, that it had a poison in it that made it difficult to have children. With a pleading look on his face, he let old Jimson put it to a vote. All those in favor of moving, count. All those in favor of staying here, count. 3 in favor, 15 against. They wouldn't count the children. Johnny would not let it go. He rose. "Please tell me," he demanded of them, "why you take this decision." An elderly man, Torrance Marshall, rose, looked around to see whether it was all right, and then spoke.
"This is our home. We are safe here. We thank you for the gifts. We are glad you are home."
He sat down. Brown Limper looked smug. The people wandered off quietly to their suppers. Johnny sat down. He held his head in his hands, defeated. He felt the parson's hand on his shoulder.
"'Tis seldom," said the parson, "that a man is a king in his own country."
"It's not that," said Johnny. "It's just that..." He couldn't finish. Over and over in his head went the words, "My poor people. Oh, my poor people." Later that night, he went up to the knoll where the cemetery had been. He searched through the snow until he found the cross of his father's grave. It had fallen over. He put it back in place and scratched the name on it. For a long, cold time, he stood looking down at the slight mound. His father had seen no sense in moving the village. Were all his people going to die here? The bitter winter wind moaned down from High Peak.